Just a little background. I've not been to ASHS meetings before. My undergraduate degree is in ornamental horticulture, so I've been wanting to come for a long time, and it took me about 30 years to finally make it, unfortunately. I have about a dozen years working for ARS in plant breeding labs. I worked for Ralph Scorza. His name had come up earlier. And then I had about 10 years working in the regulatory agency in USDA, in the Biotechnology Regulatory Services, just to give you a little background. Now I do consulting work. So I consult with people who want to get their particular genetically engineered product approved, mostly with USDA, but I'm also working with people for FDA approvals and EPA a little bit, although I probably have other people I can send them to for EPA. It's a little bit, EPA is a little bit of a different program to work with. Just for a little bit of background for people, 1986, the coordinated framework for the regulation of biotechnology was published by the U.S. government, and it defined the roles for USDA, FDA, and EPA, and how they would go about regulating genetically engineered products, mostly plants. There had not been a lot of animal work at the time, not much insect work, not a whole lot of microbe work, but what did happen was that the agencies decided not to actually come up with brand new laws, but they actually kind of pigeonholed the laws that they had in place at the time. They pigeonholed biotechnology into those laws. So laws regarding pesticides for EPA, those are included under EPA's FIFRA. I'll talk about that a little bit, very little bit. USDA's laws had to do with the Plant Quarantine Act and the Plant Pest Act. And then FDA's laws fall within the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act, which is a very old act many years ago. So here it is. The USDA APHIS regulates genetically engineered organisms under the that pose a plant pest risk under the Plant Protection Act now. Everything's been subsumed under that. I'll talk about how that came about in just a minute. The FDA regulates genetically engineered organisms and products that might be used as food or feed. So FDA has very overarching, very broad authority under the FFDCA. And then EPA regulates based on pesticides or plant incorporated protectants, as they kind of defined that back when the regulations came into place. EPA also regulates use of herbicides on particular plants, genetically engineered plants. So I'll go over each of those a little bit briefly. The major biotech crops being grown today, we're probably all pretty familiar with them. Most of them are major commodity crops, your corn, soybeans, cotton, canola. There have been some new additions recently in the horticulture world, the reduced browning apple. A company in Canada developed that. They reduced the expression of polyphenol oxidase through down regulation of four different polyphenol oxidase genes. It's working pretty well, and they're trying to go to market. I think they've got some test markets now, and that will probably broadly expand over the coming years. Another company, J.R. Simplot, has developed a late blight resistant, reduced PPO, again polyphenol oxidase, and a reduced sugar potato. So those are all broad interests from the potato industry. The late blight resistance, obviously, is a big deal. The PPO, potatoes have certain physiological problems that typically happen during cold storage. They get brown spots in them, and this reduced polyphenol oxidase addresses those. And then the reduced sugar, it's a reducing sugar, and it leads to the production of acrylamide in French fries, for example, or potatoes that are cooked at very high temperatures, like potatoes. Or like chips and fries, that sort of thing. And then, of course, as a local example, the virus-resistant papaya was one of the early products, really, that came out back in the mid to late 90s, developed in conjunction with groups in Hawaii. It's resistant to papaya ring spot virus. Currently in the state of Hawaii, these comprise somewhere over 80 or 90% of the papayas that are grown in Hawaii. And there's also a virus-resistant squash, which you don't hear much about, but it's still grown by some of the seed companies, and it does provide some significant tolerance to a couple of squash viruses. And then there's a drought-tolerant corn. I'm not sure how much that's been put into the germplasm yet of corn, but it is out there and available for use. So I wanted to focus a little bit, since we're at a horticulture meeting. There's lots of traits in crops. The ones I've got here in yellow, herbicide tolerance in an ornamental crop, for example. If one were to put glufosinate tolerance in azaleas, the agencies that one would have to deal with are USDA and EPA, and those are the only two agencies. Azaleas are not used as a food crop. They would have to get approval by the EPA to spray glufosinate on azaleas. Probably not a big deal, but they would have to get approval from USDA, because basically it's a genetically engineered plant. I'll get to the precision breeding part of things a little bit later, and we'll talk about why some things will or will not be regulated by USDA, because USDA is mostly the focus of these decisions about regulation of precision breeding at this point in time. Modified flower color, blue poinsettias, as an example. USDA would be the only regulatory agency one would have to deal with if they developed a genetically engineered blue poinsettia. Some of the challenges to commercialization, I think most people are probably pretty familiar with these. Intellectual property issues are always a big deal, and patents and licensing. These patents last for a long time. It's interesting, I had lunch the other day with Dr. Gonzalez, excuse me, who worked on the papaya, and everybody always thinks these things are a big deal, being able to license intellectual property. He told me that he paid about $25,000 one time to get all the licenses required for the patents for the papaya. So that was pretty significant. It's not as bad as people might think it would be. Then, of course, people read about the cost for development and regulatory approvals. Some recent economic analyses put out on some of the major commodity crops relate to or push forward the idea that it'll cost you $100 million or more to bring a product to market. Just not the case. Again, Dennis Gonzalez did it. Ralph Scorza did it with a virus-resistant plum. The Apple guys, they certainly didn't have $100 million to use. Very small company. So people have been able to navigate the regulatory issues with a whole lot less than $100 million. Don't let the $100 million scare people away from talking to regulators and trying to get approvals. A lot of this money, although a lot of it is, does focus on regulatory costs, there's also international approval costs that go into this $100 million. So, and those are big, because obviously those people growing commodity crops are going to have to get international approvals. And that can be very challenging in a lot of the major trading partners' countries. So FDA regulation, although it's a voluntary program to go to FDA for approval, everybody who has gone through with all their approvals has gone to FDA, and nobody wants to be the first person to not go to FDA to get their blessing, if you will. And basically what they regulate, it looks at nutrition and it looks at safety issues. So it's basically looking at is the food as safe as current foods that we eat, or both food and feed. So it's not just human food, but it's animal feed also. EPA regulation, their regulation regarding pesticide use is very, very broad. Their definition of a pesticide uses the words mitigate, repel, or somehow or other address, trying to deal with the disease. And it can also, if you look very specifically at their definition, it can also cover things that are one might consider growth regulator aspects of things. So they can choose to define what might fall under their regulation as they see fit at a particular time. There may be some instances of some products that might be developed that, although if you widely define what they've got, they might consider it a pesticide. The agency has some discretion and may choose not to require registration. And this is where it can be helpful to go in and talk to the agency and find out if there's discretion with some things or not. And again, the processes, genetically engineered things, they're applicable to anyone who wants to market a product that has pesticidal intent. And again, that word intent is really key to the EPA regulations. Their regulations are intent-based. If you don't have an intent and you don't market something with a particular intent, you're not going to be required to be regulated by EPA. So that you can go out and look in the marketplace for various products that don't specifically say that they have an intent to be pesticidal in nature. They may be just increasing nutrition or bio-nutritional or something like that. And these marketers who have developed these sorts of things, they have very good lawyers. And as long as their label doesn't indicate intent for use as a pesticidal product, then one may not have to go to EPA for registration of a product. So that's kind of a big deal. There's lots of products out there like that. You can see them marketed widely. They're not EPA approved or registered. And now we'll get to USDA, which has been one of the agencies recently who's been trying to change their regulations. Historically, their regulation triggers revolved around the use of plant pest issues, and in doing that, if you look historically at the first instances of genetic engineering of plants, people used Agrobacterium tumefaciens, which is a plant pest. People used a lot of plant viral promoters in their constructs. And those two things in and of themselves, to USDA at the time and even currently, constitute triggers for regulation. So if anybody used those sorts of technologies at the time, which now are old technology, I think we would consider, they would be regulated by USDA APHIS. And they would be regulated all the way from, if you want to ship something from one state to another, or if you want to do a field trial, or if you want to commercialize something, get it deregulated, if you will. I'm going to talk about how USDA is trying to move beyond these particular triggers and open up what I think is probably some beneficial aspects for horticultural crops. So Bob Trajano talked about Dennis Gray and his precision breeding. Dennis had sent a letter into USDA a couple of years ago describing what he was doing with his grapes and calling it precision breeding. And the USDA looked at his description and said to Dennis, based on what you're telling us, we're not going to regulate you. So Dennis's cisgenic, if you will, or precision bred grapes using Agrobacterium, but using grape genes primarily, the USDA decided they were not going to regulate that. So that kind of fell out from under regulation. Any and all of these gene editing or genome editing technologies that we've been talking about, USDA has said on numerous occasions, given what you're telling us about how you've made these things, we're not going to regulate you. So you can avoid USDA regulations by using these genome editing technologies. USDA doesn't have a great definition of how to deal with these things in their regulations, so they've developed kind of a one-off, and one can send a letter to the agency, then go to the website. I've got the website there. Find the link to Am I Regulated? And you can read all the letters that have been sent to USDA over the past, four or five or six years, I think. And these have been sent in by university people. They've been sent in by ARS. They've been sent in by companies, all sorts of people, asking USDA if what they're doing, their technologies that they're using, are going to be regulated by USDA. And you can see USDA's response on these in these letters. So I, if you're not familiar with these, I encourage you to go there and look at them. Ralph Scores' Early Flowering Plum. That was one where I believe they told Ralph that, given what you're telling us, he had done the post EFT breeding work and had come out with products at the other end that did not have the early flowering trait, and the USDA told him that they were not going to regulate those. So USDA has been trying to develop new regulations for over 10 years, I think. It's kind of fits and starts. Things change with the administrations. All sorts of things can occur to kind of derail making new regulations for a government agency. They did publish a draft rule for public comment earlier this year. That comment period closed. A lot of people sent in comments, and what they were proposing in their new regulations would officially eliminate the use of Agrobacterium or plant pest sequences as triggers for regulation. So one would not even need to send the USDA a letter anymore. If they're using Agrobacterium and plant pest sequences for what they're doing, they wouldn't even have to send the agency a letter anymore. Most of those letters are pretty short anyway, a couple of pages. So it hasn't been a particularly problematic thing for most developers who've been doing these things. But if you have to go through the whole deregulation process, that's where our chestnut guys are talking 2 to 4 years. So it can take a long time. And I will leave it at that. I'm sure we have time for questions. The USDA has not finalized its regulations about the use of plant pest sequences and Agrobacterium. There's one other thing I wanted to say, but I'll hold off for now. So if we have questions, I'm happy to take them. We've got one over here.
So last time I talked with Ralph was a couple of years ago about USDA requiring a whole genome sequence to show that the EFP gene, there was no remnant of the EFP, so they don't require that anymore, just segregation?
Well, I don't know. Again, it's one of these things with these letters, they're kind of working on a case-by-case basis. And because it's not official in the regulations yet, they do have some discretion in this case by case situation. And you, if you read those letters, you can see the discretion they're using in what they're doing. So, yeah. Yeah, so if strawberries are not already, or if glyphosate is not already labeled for use on strawberries, somebody would need to go to EPA and talk to them about that. It's a little bit tricky with glyphosate these days because there's so many registrants, it's off patent, and there's a lot of people selling glyphosate products. But in that case, I would recommend somebody goes to talk to EPA about that.
Has there been any change in the attitude toward glyphosate now that there's some rumor that it's a carcinogen?
Well, it's good. It's a good question. You know, there's a lot of pressure on EPA to take harder looks at glyphosate. As of right now, I think they were due to look at it and come out with a new report in the next year or so. I don't think they have changed their stance on it. They looked very carefully at the IARC report that came out and really felt, I think, that it was pretty weak with the data that they were using to support their conclusion. Just not good data. It was mostly, well, it's hard for me to tell, but almost everything you see after that, you don't see anybody else following up with, oh yeah, it's a carcinogen. Even the EU regulators, two different EU regulatory bodies have said, this is nonsense. This is not a carcinogen. So there's pressure on the agency and there's pressure on Monsanto, but yeah. That's operating as far as I know right now. It's operating at the genus level. I think what they've been mostly focusing on is probably, and I wasn't involved in Dennis's letter when he sent it into the agency. More often than not, what they look at are these things sexually compatible. So if they are sexually compatible, and that may or may not take it outside the genus. I don't know. Usually it's going to keep it within the genus, but one could always ask the regulators. I don't think they've specifically said that. Dennis had a very specific intent with what he was doing and was able to do what he wanted to do. But it's still a case by case assessment by the agency. Yeah. Sure. Well, yeah, that's a very good question. I gave a talk at a meeting in Brussels, I think 10 or 12 years ago when I was with APHIS, and we were talking about all the new breeding technologies, and at the time everybody over there, all the EU regulators, they're all kind of throwing up their hands. We don't know what we're going to do, but we have a meeting next year about it, and the next year and the next year and the next year. It just never ends. There's a lot of pressure in the EU from the green groups and others to regulate everything. For those who want to deal in international trade, it can be really problematic. A lot of these gene edited things are, if you can make determinations, it's not like you're looking for an NPT2 gene. If you can find the change at all, you may be lucky. You may not even be able to find the change. And then, of course, there's the instance of the orange petunias, which people may or may not be aware of recently in the U.S. That was easy to find, obviously. But some of the genome editing work, very difficult to test for it, because obviously people want to be able to test for things relatively easily and inexpensively. But if you do some of this genome editing and you can't test for something, it really brings into question, why am I regulating this? And I think that's what some of the EU regulators are looking at. Yeah. So the orange petunia, there was a short blurb, I think, in Science that came out. This was several months ago. There was a guy. I think he was a plant breeder in the Netherlands, I believe. Finland. He was in Finland, and he was just walking to work one day, or riding his bicycle to work, and he looked down and he said, "Wow, there's orange petunias. I didn't know there were orange petunias in the petunia germplasm." And he went home and thought about it. And a couple of weeks later, he was at a party or something, and ran into a buddy of his. Well, this buddy of his happened to be a regulator, an EU regulator, and he started to talk to the guy about it. And from there, of course, things kind of mushroomed, and And the EU regulator talked to whomever he wanted to talk to. And if you go back far enough, I think you can find instances of orange petunias in the literature. And they finally tracked it back to somewhere. But by then, when this guy saw this orange petunia in somebody's garden, the germplasm had spread widely, and you can't really track them once you get to a certain point. There were multiple companies using the germplasm that had the orange in it. And in the U.S., in the U.S., the USDA regulators, they got wind of it, I think, from the EU, and they immediately said, oh, no more orange petunias in the U.S. They're illegal. They haven't gone through our deregulation process. And they hadn't. They hadn't officially gone through USDA's deregulation process. I don't think they ever even did any field trials in the U.S., but the germplasm made it here. So USDA, in its infinite wisdom, decided that they called up all the companies that might have orange petunia germplasm and said, you need to get rid of your orange petunias that you're out there trying to sell. And this was in the spring. I went out looking for orange petunia germplasm. I looked for plants. I looked for seeds. Unfortunately, I went out about a week or two after this announcement came out in the news. And there were none to be found anymore. They were gone. I don't know if people snapped them up or did you snap some up? Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to do that. I wanted to do that so bad. But by the time I went out, they were all gone. So essentially, USDA said these are illegal, and they told the companies to get rid of all their stocks of orange petunias. But then, even beyond that, they had to stop any importation of orange petunias from overseas. So that's done by the USDA's Plant Protection and Quarantine Group. And then you have to inform all the ports, all the inspectors at all the ports in PPQ, that if you see any orange petunias, you need to stop them. Send them back or destroy them or call somebody up. And so the program I used to work for made these pronouncements. In their pronouncement, they said, we don't think there's any problem with the orange petunias. Doesn't pose a plant pest risk. It's no big deal, but they're illegal. So we're going to make them all go away. So that's what happened. Sadly, my wife had to deal with a lot of that because she works for PPQ. And she's over here. Anything else for now? Okay. Thank you very much.